Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Byrds told us the formula for fame. Just buy a guitar, take the time to learn how to play, then sell your soul to the record company to become a plastic product. You could say that worked for the Monkees, maybe the Beatles, I don't know. But is that really what it takes to become famous? Cass R. Sunstein has written a book about how to become famous. It's How to Become Famous: Lost Einsteins, Forgotten Superstars, and How the Beatles Came to Be. And Cass, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for that song.
And so, are you famous, Cass?
No, not at all. Maybe in my household, maybe a little bit with my dog, but otherwise not.
You got a lot of famous in your household going on there. But, I mean, you've written a lot of books, a lot of papers. You worked in the Obama administration. You're a Harvard business guy, you know. Why aren't you famous?
Well, I've never been on the cover of People magazine. I've never been on the cover of Time. I think if you ask the average person on the street if they know who I am, they'd say, well, I kind of know who Joe Biden and Donald Trump are, and maybe I know who Tom Brady is, and Bob Dylan maybe, and Taylor Swift certainly, but Cass what, I think they might say.
Yeah, but they can name all the Kardashians.
I profoundly hope so.
So the nature of fame, who gets to break out into the public consciousness and become a commodity of sorts? It's a question of information theory. How does the idea of an individual become so portable that we know who they are instantly, whether we just hear their first name, maybe their voice, maybe see their image, but bam, we know who they are. That's famous.
That certainly is famous. There are probably people who don't quite fit that criteria who are famous, but that's a good start.
So why do you think our society, it seems to be more fame-driven now than ever before? There are so many, you ask young people in school, what do you want to be? What do you want to, what's your career plan? And the number one response is a YouTube star. What's going on there?
Well, I'd like to see the data there. I'm kind of an empirical-minded person. If it's the case that American teenagers most want to be a YouTube star, I'd kind of ask what question elicited that answer. To the extent that people want to be famous, it's probably that they associate being famous with other things they care about, such as, you know, having enough money to pay your rent, being able to attract friends and maybe romantic interest, being comfortable in multiple ways in life, maybe having self-esteem. In my view, the pursuit of fame maybe isn't the best thing we could imagine, but if people want to pursue it, it's probably because of the things it makes possible.
So in your book, you poke holes in the idea that just because someone is famous doesn't mean that they are absolutely the best at what it is that they're famous for, that there may be other people just as good or maybe even better who didn't quite get that level of notoriety. So can you kind of flesh that out?
Yeah. So the book is really about the lottery that we're all in, basically every moment of our lives. So Let's take Taylor Swift. I think she's really, really, really good. And the reason I had three reallys rather than 17 is I don't want to try your patience. But she won a lottery. Actually, she won a bunch of lotteries where she got people liking her early on. She won a contest early on. Her parents moved her to Nashville early on. These are kind of a bunch of lotteries that happened in her favor. Muhammad Ali, who's kind of my favorite boxer, he's the Taylor Swift of sports, I say, or she's the Muhammad Ali of music. Muhammad Ali, why did he become a boxer? Well, he got his bicycle stolen when he was 12, and the police officer to whom he came and said, I want to whoop the person who stole my bicycle. The police officer said, well, you got to learn how to whoop. And I happen to have a boxing gym nearby. So he won the lottery that way. The Beatles almost didn't make it at all. There were about seven lotteries that they ended up drawing a winning ticket on. So the idea that Taylor Swift is the very best singer, I happen, kind of my heart says yes, but my head says there are others who are really good we've never heard of. They never got a chance. The idea that there could be another Muhammad Ali, my heart really says to that, yeah, right. But there are probably some amazing potential boxers who never got their bicycle stolen or who never met the police officer who happened to run a boxing gym. And this is true for people, you know, take your favorite politician or to your favorite corporate executive, or maybe not your favorite of either, but someone who's done super well. They got a lot of luck happening in their favor, and there are people who are just as amazing and maybe a lot more amazing who got, a rainy day or got a sneer rather than a smile or who happened to wear the wrong color suit in an important meeting. And the wellsprings of success and failure and fame and, let's say, unknownness, they lie in 1,001 or 10,001 factors that the beneficiary or the victim never even knows about.
And so with Muhammad Ali, I mean, he won those fights, you know, because he was the best boxer. Of course, he was a fantastic self-promoter and elevated the sport, but you can say, well, you know, Taylor Swift is a great songwriter, great performer, and she seems to be a really nice person. But, you know, there are other people, Miley Cyrus, or Ariana Grande, who seem to be her contemporaries. So you wonder, like, is there really a way to measure that talent?
You're making a great point. So in boxing, of course, Ali beat almost everyone. Joe Frazier and Ken Norton, who beat Ali, and so did Leon Spinks, but he beat almost everyone, and he was objectively incredible, and Usain Bolt could really run super fast, and Michael Jordan, my favorite basketball player, he won a bunch of championships, and that was partly because he was astonishing, and he could score when he needed to score and rebound, et cetera. So in sports, there's objective criteria. Is Stephen King the greatest novelist around? I tend to think he's off the charts good. But as you say, that's more subjective for music and for other things. It's more subjective. But even where it's objective, the fact that someone got a chance or acquired a skill, that involves winning a lottery.
All right, we're going to talk more about fame, who achieves it, who gets forgotten when we come back from the break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Yes, I'm going to be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And baby, I love you. I told that girl that my prospects were good. And she said, baby, it's understood. Working for peanuts is all there.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong to protect you and defend you. Whether you are right or wrong, someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, How to Become Famous, speaking with the author, Cass R. Sunstein. And he, you write a lot about Bob Dylan in the book, that he got to become famous, but one of his contemporaries didn't. What happened?
Well, Connie Converse was around a contemporary. She actually started writing her own folk songs before he did. And she got on national TV once, but no one even has a video of it, so it didn't exactly go viral. There are some photographs. She was unable to crack the code. She didn't have sponsors. She didn't get anything in the New York Times. She was really good and really original.
Well, you know, I actually have a cut from her, so I want to give it a listen just to compare it. Just give it a listen.
See that bird sitting on my windowsill? Well, he's saying whippoorwill all the night through. See that brook running by my kitchen door? Well, it couldn't talk no more if it was you.
So beautiful voice, wonderful wordplay in the songs that she wrote. You wonder, like, why did she get stiffed?
Well, she was maybe a little ahead of her time. That's kind of consistent with the idea that what the temper of the time is really matters. Dylan benefited from that. So did Star Wars. I think it's also the case that she just didn't get a network. So she said, she was funny, she said, I have dozens of fans all over the world, which is the kind of sensibility you see in her lyrics. They kind of produce a double take. But she actually did hit the big time decades after what's probably her death. No one knows what actually came of her. She probably killed herself, but no one knows that. So she's now on the way to becoming an icon, a little like Jane Austen, the great novelist, who was not particularly celebrated in her time, and more like John Keats, the great poet, who was thought to be one of the good ones, but not one of the greats, or William Blake, who was very obscure at the time and is now iconic. So what Connie Converse is experiencing is posthumous iconization, let's call it. And sometimes that happens in a really speeded up way in the course of a lifetime, where you have 10 years of obscurity and then you're Miley Cyrus.
Let's go to a caller, Christian. And Christian, you're on the air.
Hey, this is for you. Do you consider yourself famous, and did you want to be famous?
Who are you addressing?
You, the host.
Oh, me? No, I'm not famous, and I don't want to be famous. I like to be anonymous, so I can just, you know, read comic books and no one bother me. But Cass, you know, who wants to be famous these days?
Well, we'd have to do a poll. I teach at a law school. I don't think most of my students want to be famous. They do want to be successful. So my title is a little bit of a joke. It's a little bit mischievous, How to Become Famous. It suggests that this is a manual, a guaranteed money back, famous or money back guide. But it's really trying to investigate success as well as fame. So if you become, you know, a really well-known lawyer or a really well-known engineer or plumber or whatever, that's kind of a cousin to fame. And how does that even happen?
Well, fame can be really good because it helps us identify things that are worth exploring, listening to, you know. So like John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, you know, you can't get any better than that, 1965. Had that not been identified and someone said, this is really, really good, you need to listen to this, really, really listen to it, like multiple times for the rest of your life, then, you know, I probably would never have found it.
Not completely. So if someone is amazing, like George Lucas, who did the first six Star Wars movies, the fame actually is like a kind of permission slip or an open door for people who wouldn't otherwise think, do I want to watch a movie about robots and people chasing each other with things that are kind of like guns? But you hear it, Star Wars, it's amazing, and then you see it, and it genuinely is amazing. And this is completely true for Miley Cyrus. Thank you for mentioning her. She is fantastic, and her fame is a gift to people who get to hear her music who might otherwise listen to something less fantastic.
Well, some people produce music or other products that They seem to not find an audience in their home, but they're discovered elsewhere, you know, and they became famous elsewhere. I'm famous. I'm big in Japan, you might say, or, you know, Sugar Man, Sixto Rodriguez. I think we have a cut of that. Let's give a listen to him really quick, and you can talk about that.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes. For a blue coin, won't you bring back all those colors to my dreams?
So, Cass, what is the story of Sugar Man?
This is a guy named Rodriguez who was thought by his label in the 70s to be really good, but he didn't get any popularity in the United States or in England. He was kind of a failure, and he went back to being a construction worker, a demolition man in Detroit. Little did he know that in South Africa, he was with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan. He was Rodriguez. And people speculated what happened to him. Did he set himself on a fire? Did he quit because he was too famous? He couldn't stand it anymore. And he was actually an icon there. And it only took, you know, decades for him to learn, courtesy of a movie called Searching for Sugar Man, that there was a country, a pretty big one, South Africa, where he was a giant. Who knew? And then he had a bit of a comeback in his 60s, I think it was, having discovered that there was a movie coming out about him. And it's tempting to say he resonated with South African culture, something like that, or he hit the anti-apartheid movement. I think those are all kind of after-the-fact desperate efforts to come up with a coherent narrative. It's more that he got a kind of cascade of enthusiasm in South Africa and didn't elsewhere. Why did the Beatles do spectacularly well? Well, they're great, even better than Rodriguez, but they got a cascade of enthusiasm, not only because they were great, but also because of a network of people in Liverpool and then in London who congregated together and said, let's be part of this big thing, Beatlemania.
So this reputational cascade, as more people discover you and they become what they evangelize, how good you are, and they want to share the word, or they want to talk to other people. I wonder if fame, because we know we're a social animal, and that we have fame and we identify people to be famous in order to connect with other people as part of our social network.
Okay, so you've got three things going on in those statements. Thank you for that. And they're all really cool, though they're slightly technical. Okay, so the first is someone says there's this guy, he really knew how to write plays. It's kind of an old language, but man, was he good. And his name is Shakespeare. And the second person says, okay, sounds right, I'll read that person. And then the third person says, I don't know what to read, but the first two people say Shakespeare, so I'm going to try to read this play called Hamlet. That's an informational cascade where it's going from one person to another. And the rise of Taylor Swift actually has a lot to do with an informational cascade, just like what Shakespeare benefits from every day. Then there's a second thing, a reputational cascade, where in certain circles, if you say you like Miley Cyrus, there's a kind of nod of appreciation of you. And that there's a community, I'm not part of one, regrettably, of Miley Cyrus fans, but where to be an enthusiast for her is to get approving glances, and not to like her is to get a kind of a shake of the head. Who does this guy think he is, and why does he not know about Miley Cyrus? So a reputational cascade can occur as people are attuned not to the amazingness necessarily of the artist or the novelist, but to the reputational signal they give by favoring the novelist or the artist. And then the third is it's the network. So when I was a kid, Marvel Comics was becoming a big deal. Think Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and Thor and Black Panther. And there was a network of people who were Marvel Comics people. And there it was kind of, it's the network, stupid. It's not only the characters. Of course, it was the characters also. But for 10-year-old me to be part of a network of Marvel Comics fans was really cool. And that's different from an informational cascade or a reputational cascade. It's to be part of the group of people. I was on a Taylor Swift podcast pretty recently, and that's what they were all over. they were saying, we love being part of the network of Taylor Swift fans.
So Twiggy, I remember this British model, the very first supermodel, you know, in the swinging 60s. She was just this teenage girl, a shop girl in London, and she became elevated for her, you know, androgynous look at the time, short blonde hair, big eyelashes, but not that unusual of a person, not a great talent, but yet she was everywhere in the 60s. And now, I mean, you ask most people, if you know who Twiggy is, and they have no idea. So the fame being, you know, fleeting, is how do you process that?
It can be. So you're asking something fantastic. So there can be people like Twiggy who tragically are no longer super famous. I say that because I really like Twiggy. Never met her, but I think she was cool. So there are people who have a moment. The Dave Clark Five is a related example. They were rivals of the Beatles at a time. There were magazines saying who's better, the Beatles or the Dave Clark Five. But now you say the Dave Clark Five, and most people will think, what are you talking about? Were they real? So that's one phenomenon, fame and then obscurity. Then there's enduring fame. I think Shakespeare is maybe our best example, who's been, so far as I know, famous for a really long time. And then there's something like the Mona Lisa, which is now the most famous painting in the world. But until, you know, relatively recently in the arc of that painting's life, it was either obscure or good. But then it rose to the defining, partly because it got stolen. And after it was stolen, people thought, why did they steal this one? Mona Lisa's been stolen. And then it became known as something that really stood head and shoulders above other paintings, which is probably not at all true, but it got there. It's kind of the opposite of what you're describing with respect to Twiggy. So maybe Twiggy, model whose time is about to come again.
So if you want to become famous, develop a network of people who just think you're wonderful, become known for being famous, your work should be accessible. I think one reason why the Dave Clark Five is no longer, like, you know, talked about is because they're very strict on licensing their music even today. They're not going to get on the Golden Oldies channel, so who will discover that music? There's a lot of different things in your book that you talk about how to become famous. It's not a formula, but you can look at the little things that are improve your chances of becoming famous, not for just being famous, but for being talented. Is that it?
Yes, as you describe it, I'm thinking that Steve Jobs, you know, the kind of publicist and in some ways the genius behind Apple, and Stan Lee, the Marvel Comics guy, they had something in common. They knew a lot about how to become spectacularly successful, which involved not only being really good, but being able to create networks of iconoclasts. So that's not a term in the book, networks of iconoclasts. But if you can create a network of iconoclasts, that might vault you somewhere.
Like the Beats, like in Times Square in the 60s and 50s.
Completely, like the Beats. Or you can think of political analogs right now, maybe some political movements that you like, or maybe some that you really don't like. They're networks of iconoclasts.
Well, how to become famous if you want to be famous. I don't know why, but how to become famous, Lost Einsteins, Forgotten Superstars, and How the Beatles Came to Be, Cass R. Sunstein. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. A great pleasure.
Source continues right after this. Stay tuned.